Hi, I'm Irvin Raphael. I am here with the brand new Genesis G90, the flagship of the all-new luxury Genesis brand. Welcome to AutoLine After Hours. Thank you very much.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 343 for August 19th of 2016. The first Camaro ever and the teenager who found it. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Well, all that applause that you hear in the background is we have a group of interns joining us in the studio today. They're all from Magna Corporation, the giant Canadian automotive supplier, and we're glad that they get a chance to see a little bit behind the scenes of what AutoLine After Hours is about. My co-host, Gary Fasilash, is out driving. I think he's on the media launch for the Kia Cadenza, which is going out this week.
This week, yeah.
But we got Henry Payne as my co-pilot for the show. And Henry, it's great to have you back on the show.
Thanks, John. Good to be here.
And we got to give a plug. You're the car critic for the Detroit News.
That's right. Yeah, I'm just back.
Sound more excited about it. Come on.
Well, that's not a bad job. Yeah. In the last week, I've been in Vancouver testing a Hyundai Genesis, and then Sacramento testing a Porsche Turbo, and now I'm back here driving Camaros for the 50th anniversary all week. So it's not a bad gig.
Well, we'll talk more about the Genesis and the Porsches later in the show. But what we've got to let everybody know right now is we've got two special guests in the studio right now. Logan Lawson is the owner of Camaro number one. And I mean number one, right, Logan?
Yeah, number one.
This is the first Camaro ever built in the history of the world.
Yeah, very first.
And there's a great story behind it, but we've got to let everybody know, too, that we've got Mark Gessler, the president of the Historic Vehicle Association, with us back. You've been on our television show, but I don't think you've been on this one too.
Yeah, we were here last year with the story of going across the United States in a Model T.
In a Model T, right? Great having you here too, Mark. So Logan, I what's this whole thing? Camaro number one. I got to ask you, how old are you?
I'm 18 now.
18 years old now. Yeah. And you found out about Camaro number one. Tell us the story. How does this start?
So 13.
13 years old.
Yeah, I was 13 years old, coming up on my first car, wanting to find my first car, and was cruising after school on message boards and stuff, looking for new cars, and I came across a thread. It was a verification thread. Some guy in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, had come across N100001.
The VIN,
and he had the car, and he had the VIN number, but he didn't have any proof. He didn't have any proof that it was the very first. He just had a hunch. And I talked to my dad, and he called the guy. And then the guy called back, and he just raced down there to verify the car. We had history in automotive history before all this happened. And so he went down, and he noticed that there was just a lot of telltale signs about this car that just had to be... Since it was very first, you know, they hadn't completely finished they'd beaten out all the details on the assembly line. So we took a chance and
bought the car.
Yeah, that's where everything started. You know.
Now wait a minute, I'm intrigued. 13 years old and you're already looking for a car.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up with cars. I'm a gearhead. You know, I was looking for one.
You're already driving at 13.
Yeah, I mean, dad was taking me out on country roads. I'm from Kansas, so.
Well, you're lucky that your dad was doing that because I was driving when I was 13, but my dad had no clue what was happening.
So we took the car home and we put it in storage and we started 2 years of research to try to find proof that it was the number one because. I mean, it wasn't as easy as just calling Heritage Center and being like, hey, here's the VIN number. What do you guys have? No, all the history was pretty much lost on it. And
when you say the Heritage Center, this is GM Heritage Center, which is sort of the repository of all history things with GM now.
I mean, they didn't have anything on the car. And so we had to just kind of start digging in, and we did 2 years of tracking down all 50 years of the car. And with that, we uncovered the pilot program, which was the pilot prototype program that Norwood did in secrecy when they were still trying to figure out what they even were going to call the Camaro.
Now, so Norwood, of course, is the name of the assembly plant that, Norwood, Ohio, built the first plant to build Camaros. There were other plants later that
Van Nuys followed right after.
Van Nuys, California, right. So you're saying they were building cars?
They were. So 49 were built in secrecy in the back of Norwood in an old World War II storage hangar. Like, it's just like storage building. And they revamped the building, and they brought in guys, and they started on the 49 builds that they would reassemble, build, unassemble, reassemble. The whole purpose of the program was to learn the process so that they could teach the assembly line. And so, I mean, starting with number one, inline six, three on tree, no options. Everyone asks, why an inline six? It's a Camaro, and you should have a V8 in it. No, inline six because it's the most basic configuration you could have. You know, start with the something easy, and then throughout the 49 that they built, they started like ramping up the options, started getting into 327s, 350s, all the options, you know, dual exhaust, air conditioning, everything. And so,
Mark, you must be intrigued by this, you know, head of the Historic Vehicle Association. I'm intrigued by this 49 build, you said, pre-production? How does that work, Mark? I mean, is this anything that you had run across before?
Well, the Camaro program seemed to be really special in terms of just the secrecy behind it, which was completely unlike what Mustang was doing by contrast. I mean, you know, Ford was out there teasing the marketplace with Mustang 1, Mustang 2, and, you know, they were amping it all up. And so, I mean, of course, it came out of the gates like a rocket ship. And, of course, GM sitting there, okay, well, you know, we need to play in this game, too, but we're going to play a little different. We're going to design it, and we're going to keep it under wraps. And it was under wraps. I mean, this car was built back in May of 1966. That's why we're here. 66 on the 67. Mm-hmm. So it was a 67 model year, built in the middle of 66. And I mean, it was literally this month, August of 1966, that the dealers got together here in Detroit, booked Cadillac Hotel, still standing there downtown. And that's when it got revealed to the dealers. And within a month, September, I think, 29th, a month later, you could buy one in your showroom.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it was, as you say, it was different than the Mustang program. I mean, Chevy was really caught out by Mustang. They were promoting the, what was the rear engine, the Corvair. That was their sporty car. They didn't really take this idea serious of a pony car. And all of a sudden, Mustang comes out of the gates and sells almost a million in the first 18 months. I mean, a million of these things. Can you imagine that? A million pony cars going off the line at Ford. And so, I mean, the Chevy program is really a crash program, isn't it? I mean, as you got into the car, I mean, what did you see in the car? I mean, one of the stories of the development of this car is it's sort of half body on frame and half unibody, right, the way it's constructed.
Oh, yeah, it's pretty much exactly what you're saying. So it's like unibody, and we're looking at the car, all the pieces were marked hand-built prototype. You know, they're still they were working directly with Fisher Body, and they were really close, so anything that they needed to change, they just tell Fisher Body half a day later, just ship it back. And they were beating out all the details in the process.
So in today's world, you know, automakers will build what they call pre-production cars.
Yeah.
And it's not the mules that are tested out at the proving ground. These are built in the assembly plant, you know, production intent. And these days they'll build like 150 cars, and then they'll get them into the hands of employees and dealers and all that for fast feedback, trying any kind of problems or anything like that. And when that program's done, they're crushed, and that's that.
Yeah.
But you're saying you've got your hands on what really is kind of a pre-production car number one, and it ended up for sale.
Yeah, so what you're talking about, the mules and stuff, the mules were also part of the 49. So, like, a certain amount of the 49 were sales convention cars, a certain amount were mules, a certain amount went on road trips to California.
Development.
Yeah, and that's when they figured out axle hop, and they had to change all that on the SS. And so the sales convention cars, they were required with show paint, and they had number one was it had a static lighting display. You plug it into 110, and they could flash all the lights to music. And so at the hotel where it was unveiled, it had a static lighting display. We have a film that is VIN number specific for when it was unveiled at the sales convention, and showing all the lights flashing, and it's pretty cool. So,
yeah, I'm kind of knocked out about this, that what's clearly a development car. Mm-hmm. This one was not a mule, though.
No.
If people don't know, mules are, that's the inside industry jargon. That's the car that you take out and beat the hell out of on the test track.
Yeah. No, so sales convention cars, they, and the build, the body tags, they were all manipulated by they manipulated the IBM computer so that they would be actually able to sell them. They would get past legal. And so once the sales convention cars were done, the dealers had the option to get them. And so some of the biggest dealers, like Artier, the first owner of a number one, also 36, also 49, he requested number one. He saw the significance of number one. And so he got three cars right off the sales convention cars. So theoretically he could be the very first, Camaro collector ever. So,
yeah, it's interesting because 50 years removed, we all look at these cars as icons, but at the time, this is a crash program. I've got a Porsche 908, which has become an iconic Porsche racing car. But same thing in the 60s when Porsche was racing. I mean, these were crash 1 year programs to try to get these things out the door. And my car was crashed in its first race by Porsche. Goes into the privateer market, and it's really hard to track down its provenance, where it gets handed down. I mean, how did you piece that together? When you got this car, it had no engine in it, right?
Oh, no, it had an engine.
It had an engine? Yeah.
We kind of get into that. That's later into the history, but tracking down the provenance, it had several owners. So it went from Artier's used it as a selling point, had it right in the middle of his showroom, and he would just use it to bring in people and to sell the 67 Camaro, 68 Camaro. And then he had it for about 2.5 years, and then after that he sold it to a family friend that I went to church with, Linda Sue Johnson, and then she drove it and then sold it to Alvis Harper, which was the father of the captain of the football team, straight A student. He needed a car, and then, unluckily enough, Alvis, his son or his adopted son, because Alvis couldn't have kids, he talked his dad into getting him a high performance car because the inline six wasn't doing it enough for him, and. His son passed away in the car, in the new car. And so Alvis, seeing the car in his garage for 6 months, every time he passed it, he just couldn't stand it. And so he just shoveled it off real quick to any guy that would buy it right away. And that was a local race car builder. And the race car builder, So Linda Sue Johnson, Alvis Harper, even the race car builder, they all knew of the significance that it was the very first. And so the race car builder went in, and when he was turning into an NHRA bracket racer, he stripped all the original parts off of it and saved them. And so when he did that, and then he started racing it, and it was a very...
At that point, he put a different drive
train
in.
Could he put a cage in it? Roll bar and all
that? Yeah. He put a big block, put a whole new powertrain in it, made it kind of lightweight, saved everything that he took off of it. He saved, he packaged it up, put it in his barn. It wasn't the first car that he had stripped. When we were tracking down all the heritage of this car and finding all the original owners, there was 5 different cars worth of parts that, we found in the barn, and he was on his last leg, and to get the parts that we needed, we had to buy the whole barn. And so we've been selling parts that he stripped off.
So wait a minute, you bought the car,
yeah,
and then found out later there's all these original parts.
Yeah. So
how did you make these connections?
Well, we knew that we needed to catalog the history of the car, and so we just started with ownership history.
And you had the VIN.
I mean, we had the VIN.
You had the VIN.
Yeah. And so we were able to go to each state. I mean, there was a period of time we were sending out the VIN to every single state in the country. So I'm trying to figure out where it went, and figured out that its whole life was in Oklahoma. Hmm. And so, we tracked down every single owner. We tracked down, and we went into the ownership really detailed. If they weren't alive, we tracked down their, like burial site, took pictures of it. We talked to members of their family that were still alive. And I mean, luckily enough, we were able to get to the race car builder before he died. And so we were able to get all the original parts, reunite them with the original body, and then
you had to take the engine out. You had to restore.
Yeah,
restoration. Yeah,
yeah. The car when we found it, 10 to 15 years bracket racer. It was in need of restoration. And then when we found all the original parts, we saved most of them, restored them. I mean, they're all really in need of restoration. Besides, the body panels and all that stuff, we still. Once we put it through a 4-year restoration, and anything that we couldn't save, we replaced with properly date coded. I mean, everything's original on it. So
yeah,
it's an outstanding piece of research, and you know that's what attracted us to the whole project, because you know here you had not only number one, but you also had really a great story of stewardship, the effort, that Corey and his dad and everybody else that was involved put into this project, where we now have a really, really tight record, thanks to these guys, to really lean on, and where in many cases you don't have that. And it just, you know, so that, and then obviously we had the 50th anniversary. Yeah. So things came together in a great way to be here on Woodward with the 15th car on the National Historic Vehicle Register.
Mark, how important is a car like this? I mean, you're the guy who's, you know, tracking the history of these things.
Well, it's incredibly important in the sense that it's the first, okay? But what's important about it is it represents really an important point in automotive history in America, because it was this car, not this, you know, it's the Camaro that launched really the biggest rivalry that's, among the biggest rivalries in the history of the automotive industry. And it's one that continues to rage today. And if you talk about, I mean, we're out here, we're at Woodward, we're seeing what's happening out here. Everybody identifies with the Camaro Mustang story. And it's part of America. It's a deep part of our culture. It's something that everybody celebrates, and almost everybody's got a connection to. It's part of automobility. It's part of it's part of who we are. And a car like this, I mean, and the decades that followed, it's deep into American culture and something that we want to celebrate. And when you have an artifact like this, where you can point to it and say, oh my goodness, the first one, really, I think it helps people sort of identify with the entire story and their own story. And our whole objective is to bring America's automotive heritage to the American people. And so we put it on display out here at Woodward in a museum-style case, glass case, right next to Woodward for this week. And it's the idea of bringing heritage here, something important that people wouldn't have otherwise seen.
In fact, we've got a time-lapse video that we shot, had shot, of the car being loaded into its glass box. It's like a trophy case.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Trophy box.
Yeah.
Hey, Carmen, let's run that video clip right now.
So the showcase is right there where Old Woodward meets New Woodward Avenue on in Birmingham. So it's right there on display. And before this, it was the National Mall earlier this year where we had Reagan's Jeep from the Reagan Ranch and the first presidential car in it, right there, right in the middle of the National Mall. So it's a great piece, a great showcase, a great way to really expose just everybody, you know, all ages. And, you know, I say it's not just for car guys, although car guys love it. It's also all about, you know, sharing it with the American people. So, you know, everybody loves it, and it's a great way to share something special. And, boy, this is something pretty special.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But look, I'm intrigued by the father-son project on this. My father and I have done the same thing and raced historic cars for years. I mean, is this the beginning of a long partnership? I mean, you must have the restoration bug. What's next?
Working with GM Heritage, I mean, when we unearthed the pilot book, which was like kind of like the holy grail of the pilot prototypes like program, it had the build of every single 49 cars, and I mean it was in possession of the pilot coordinator, the person in charge of the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And so when we found that, we were able to start tracking down, we started working with Heritage, and they were like, well, I mean, you did such a good job on number one. Can you document all 49 cars along with the 3 knockdown copies that they sent to Van Nuys for learning purposes at Van Nuys, since that was another production plant? And so, I mean, in the process of we were trying to figure out how many cars actually existed to today, because you're right. I mean, a lot of them were crushed. I mean, a lot of them were mules, but the sales convention cars got out lucky. And some of them were given to top brass, you know, some of them were not. And so along with that, we found that there were about 10 that still existed. All of them have been verified. We went to, made sure that they were real deal. And along with that process, we were able to acquire some of the other pilot prototypes. And so we have other prototypes that are in the rest that are lined up for restoration.
Oh, that's right. There's about 4 of them, right?
Yes.
What do you got? You got 15?
We have 1, 10. 10 is the sister car of 1, all Granada gold, just like 1, but convertible. And it's the earliest known to exist convertible to exist right now. And then we have 31. Which is nothing. It's the only thing special about it is a pilot prototype. It's red, black convertible, and then 49. So that's the second prototype Z28 to come out of the engineering garage at GM. And so, those are all lined up. And then four of the 49 were used for, they were ordered Omit powertrain. So they were sent off without anything besides just the body, everything on it, and then they were stripped because this was going on right during Lunar Rover kind of GM thing. And in our research, we found out that GM had a giant, tremendous part in the Lunar Rover. I mean, we have more stuff to break later, but I mean, that's another time.
That's right. A lot of people don't know that General Motors was involved in the design of the Lunar Rover.
Lunar Rover, is it a solid rear axle or is it a rear?
So the 4, they actually stripped it down to meet weight, and they tested reliability test for all the components that ran on the Lunar Rover. And so after that, the 4 cars were then, all the components were taken off and then sent to the engineering garage, the prototype garage, and so 49, prototype Z28, second, and then 28, the Californian factory prep race car, other ones just, they were all turned into, the Alexander brothers, they were big on the scene, custom car makers, GM, a lot of the, they specialized in faux grills, and they were big on the sales convention cars. And they were in charge of 3 of them, along with the Californian. The Californian special, because it has a bubble hood, They were advertising the possibility of factory prep race cars, and so it was so it has a bubble hood like the Cherokee, you know, the Corvette Cherokee.
No, don't know that either.
So the bubble hood with the Webers underneath. So you at the show you could see the Webers because it had a clear bubble on the top of the hood, and so they were during that time they were advertising all that. So we have prototypes that are coming up and. Big stories going on with GM involvement, electric car stuff that'll break. Hopefully, we'll be back to talk to you again.
Cool. No. Hey, we've got a couple of questions coming in from the audience. Armin wants to know, has Chevy ever tried to buy the car back from you?
No, that is a very popular question. And honestly, we got the car completely restored. And then, I mean, we were working with GM Heritage, and they've never needed to buy the car from us because they're like, hey, can you be here? And we're like, certainly, yeah, why not? Why not work with GM on helping showcase this car? And so 2016 unveil at Belle Isle, Barrett-Jackson, Arizona during the Kettering donation, the charity car that they sold. And, we're working with GM on this event, too. And so they've never really needed to buy the car from us.
Armin also wants to know, would you ever sell it?
I'm hoping to keep it in the family.
I think the price just went up.
Hey, he's got four more.
Bob D. wants to know, how many of the pre-production 49s are still in existence?
So that's the 10.
The 10,
That's the number, the 10 that we've all verified. And, certainly there could be ones that are in trailers that we have not been able to track down, but unlikely because we've been through... I mean, we've worked with FBI. We've definitely been through knocking on all the doors. So,
Steve wants to know: were you a GM guy before all this?
Oh man. Okay, so if you go to the website and go to about this site, it's the whole story of me. And there's pictures of me when I'm this tall underneath an original a 427 AC Cobra. And so.
So you were not a GM guy.
No, for Shelby.
All right.
No, you know, we had to switch gears when we stumbled on this. I mean, one of the biggest things we've grown up with, we really loved race history, and we loved just the provenance of the car. And so when we stumbled on this, I mean, it wasn't like we loved Ford and we didn't like Chevy. It was just more of the story behind the car. So, I mean, we just kind of switched gears.
Yeah. Mark, how'd you get involved in this effort?
Well, we had learned about the car about a year and a half ago, and I was actually at the Carlisle Nationals, and we sat down and started talking, talking and going through some of the research, and we were just blown away by really the great work, the great stewardship that these guys did together to bring this all together, and with that we started saying, well, you know, let's. We've got a slot for this. Mm-hmm. We just got to figure out when and what makes the most sense, and when there's when is the opportunity to tell the story to the greatest amount of people, and that's why we're here.
Yeah. Hey, we've got a phone call that's coming in here too. Carmen, let's bring that phone call in.
This is Clem Zarovsky in Delmont, Pennsylvania. I just wanted to say that gentleman with that Camaro is extremely lucky because of federal law now, you cannot trace people. Previous owners of cars. A lot of people with collector cars are running into this. For a while there, you have to have a case number from the police department before they will release any information. So this gentleman was really, really lucky.
Yeah, we.
Thanks for the call, by the way.
Yeah, I mean that it was. I mean, it wasn't like it was easy. Jamie Schwartz and I, and then a few other of our, some of my high school friends helped me out. I needed help. And so, more times than not, we got answers saying, hey, we can't help you. You know, we can't give you this information, but we just kept on trying. And you would find the people that just liked our story and they would, you know, do it in their free time. I mean, I'm not saying that. You know, they were supposed to.
Don't name names. Right?
Yeah. I'm not saying they were supposed to, but they're definitely beneficial to find in history. I mean, you got to have those people. I mean, especially in this kind of circumstance, you got to have the people that will take a chance. And, as Mark, points out, the car without the history is just, there's, not that much there. So.
Well, the interesting thing on what the caller says is, I mean, I find it fascinating that we can find out all the personal information about, you know, when your grandparents got here, exactly when they arrived in this country, but we can't find out anything about any cars that actually are owned by anybody. Mm-hmm. Seems rather strange, but that's the way we are.
Look, this is a fascinating story. I'm so glad that you guys came over here today. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to have to get out on Woodward and check out and see the car firsthand for myself.
Definitely give you a tour.
Logan, thanks so much for coming on the show. This has been a great story. And Mark, great having you back, too.
Thank
you.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Okay,
yeah.
We're going to take a quick break here. We're going to let these guys go, bring in a couple of my other colleagues, and we'll talk about some of the news of the week. And we'll be back.
Lear Kinexis offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts, all delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
And there is more applause from the interns from Magna. And Henry's still here with us. But we've also got Seth Miersma from Motor One.
Motor One.
So great having you on the show.
Good to be here.
Last time you were on the show, you were not with Motor One.
I wasn't. No. I was with Autoblog.com before this. But change of career and a new website that we launched in April. So
tell us a little bit about Motor One.
So Motor One is a news and review site primarily, and we just launched the new website in April of this year. The kind of hook of the site is that we're building a big U.S. and global main site right now. We're going to have local editions kind of all over the world. So we've got, by local edition, I mean editors in those countries writing natively in their own languages. So we launched Canada right after we did the U.S., we've got a French site up and running now. We actually have a Turkish site up and running, and we're working on the UK. And before long, we'll have Italy, Spain, Spanish language US. And so it's a very global proposition.
Yeah, very interesting. No one else has done that, have they?
Yeah, now there have been a couple of attempts out there, and there are some, certainly there are automotive sites all over the world, but I mean
one entity doing multiple sites in different languages.
Not to this scale, not to my knowledge, and we have a really good model. Motorsport.com is actually sort of the parent site and set up this model for us over the last 2 years. They've built a tremendous network of racing news sites across the world with the same thing, lots of local talent and really, really great content. So we're in Detroit right now. The headquarters is on the north side of Detroit, and we're really hoping to kick it off in a strong fashion over there and sort of help build out the rest of the world.
And you sort of brought a team. You guys have worked together.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a sort of a family reunion, too. Isn't it?
It is, yeah.
But is this like the Autoblog family, so to speak?
It's been called Autoblog 2.0 at certain points. No, I mean, the opportunity was really good that I was able to work with Stephen Ewing. Was one of the first guys that I talked to about coming over. He's our managing editor now. John Neff is the editor-in-chief.
John helped launch Autoblog.
John was the Autoblog OG. He was there from the very beginning, and kind of the man behind the curtain. He's one of the kind of most savvy digital guys that I know, and really great to work with too. So so we've got a team of five guys now in Detroit, and a much bigger team at our headquarters in Miami. So we're really excited about it. We're having fun.
Cool. Good to get that update.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Henry, you've been driving cars this week or the last week and a half.
Yeah, the fall flood is beginning here, I think. Yeah, still a lot of cars to come this year from the auto shows.
Well, yeah, as you saw at the very beginning of the show, we sort of had it kicked off by Irvin Raphael, who's, I guess, the brand manager for Genesis.
Right.
And here's Hyundai really finally launching a separate luxury brand. I know something that they've been dying to do for years, but...
Yeah, and it's interesting to watch it happen. I mean, launching a luxury brand doesn't come along every day. This is the third, if you include Alpha, since the turn of the century, Tesla being the other one. So, you know, it's a big decision for an automaker. And Hyundai's really following the Toyota map. Toyota scaled to a certain production number in this country and felt that they could then move to a luxury brand where they can just pull their existing customers into a luxury brand. I mean, that's sort of their base. And Hyundai's doing the same thing. They've doubled sales in the last decade from 400,000 to 800,000. So they got a base of customer who they feel will move into a luxury car. But ultimately, they got to compete in this segment. And boy, I mean, it is an extremely competitive segment.
Everybody wants to get into luxury cars.
Right. But I think Genesis is smart. I mean, everybody's been kind of retooling in this segment. There's new players like Tesla and Alpha, older players like Cadillac and Lincoln remaking their business models. And
Volvo reinventing
that's
itself.
Right, right. Volvo and got the SUV of the year last year. But it's interesting. I think Genesis is smart, and they're coming in with what people know about them, which is tremendous value for the dollar. I mean, this car is an incredible value for what is in it, and there's a lot of familiar styling in it. Looks like an Audi from the front. Looks like a Mercedes.
There,
we've
got a picture of one up there, and you're right. There is some Audi in that, isn't there?
So stylistically, they're not trying to reinvent the wheel. I mean, they're presenting something that's familiar to the luxury customer, and then bringing it in at $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 cheaper than what else is in the market. So
all of the content that you could hope to have, and all those competitors too.
That's right. And that's what's one of the things that's interesting to me. And it'll be interesting to see how long they continue this, because luxury, famously, you know, you want big margins in luxury, so you want to mark up for packages like moonroofs and technology. This is basically a Scion model or a Saturn model in luxury. I mean, this thing, everything is standard on this car. You come in, you get one price for this car, and the only options are a V8 engine and all-wheel drive. That's it. I mean, it's like buying a Scion for $60,000. You know?
Now it doesn't sound like such a hot deal. But how are they going to sell it? Because when Lexus launched, when Infiniti launched, they did it with separate dealers. In fact, one of the real success stories behind Lexus is they went out and cherry-picked the best retailers in the country. And they wrote a franchise agreement unlike what anybody had done at that point. Yeah. In fact, Saturn, which you mentioned, borrowed a lot of the same ideas when it launched from a distribution standpoint. So is that what they're going to do with Genesis, or am I going to have to go to a Hyundai store to buy one?
Yeah, to begin with, you'll go to a Hyundai store. And, I mean, they'll go to their big, their big dealers, and those will be the first to get a standalone bricks and mortar. But, we all like product. We like driving product. We like talking about product. But a big piece of luxury is the dealer experience, and there's a lot of investment. That's why I like
it. But it's not just even the dealer experience. It's also just the brand image.
That's right.
You know,
right.
If I'm going to buy a car that I'm going to tell my friends is as good as a BMW or a Benz or an Audi,
right,
and I got to go to a, you know, and I'm not trying to put them down, but I got to go to a Hyundai dealer to buy this. That just doesn't cash the check when it comes to having cachet.
Exactly. So I think as they introduce this, I mean, initially, they want to ramp up through their big dealers, and ultimately that's where the separate buildings will come. But you'll see these things side by side. They'll be put in a corner, but they'll be in there with Hyundais. But the dealer experience has to be different for that customer. You'll have dedicated people in the showroom, so that when customers come in for that car, they get special service. And I think a big piece of this is customers, once they buy the car, they can actually buy the car online. They never have to see the dealer. I mean, when they get serviced, the dealership comes to them, picks up the car, takes it in. So to some degree, the idea is that the Genesis customer will be so pampered, they'll never know that they're part of a Hyundai dealership.
Very interesting.
What's interesting to me is the conservative nature with which Hyundai is kind of approaching this whole plan. Howdy.
And just so the audience knows, Seth just said howdy to David Welch, who's in the studio with us now. Uh-huh. Good having you.
Hi, Dave.
Hello. How's it going? Good to see everybody.
Yeah.
So go on.
I was just saying, they've got this dealership within a dealership approach. They've talked about maybe selling these at half of the dealerships or less to sort of start out with. They did a really soft launch by having Genesis the car and Equus the car before they launched the actual luxury brand. But then that's kind of combined with the fact that when you look at them versus the Toyota model, it's like they're doing the Toyota model at double the speed that Toyota did it too. So this conservative model, this kind of like fast progress through conservative steps is really interesting to me. And I don't know. It's going to be cool to see whether or not they can pull it off for the full luxury line, too.
So, David Welch, what do you think? Has Hyundai got a chance of really breaking into the luxury market with this Genesis brand?
Yeah, I think they do. They've had some really cool stuff. I was talking to Bob Watts about this not long ago, and he saw the concept at the New York show, and he said he told some friends at GM that it's something they ought to pay attention to, and it's a gorgeous car. You know, you're talking about the dealer experience and how they're going to do that. That's going to be really important because a dealer within a dealer is probably the way to go, at least to start. Because if you start doing separate showrooms, the dealers want volume, and they want it pretty fast. And then you're under all kinds of pressure to make bad decisions, especially for a luxury brand. If you got to start pushing volume and making a lot of different models just to placate the dealers. That's the mistake GM really made with Hummer, right? Is it was standalone, mm-hmm. separate dealerships. The dealers, and look, they buy a lot of land. They spend a lot of money on Quonset hunts. They need volume to pay for that and make sense out of right. that. If they had just folded those into a Cadillac dealership, the way Scion is folded into a Toyota dealership, the brand doesn't need to be really super high volume. It can be whatever it needs to be and grow at its at the right rate mm-hmm. without damaging the brand. So that's probably a pretty low risk approach, and unless they really get the separate showrooms yeah. mandated pretty quickly.
Well, it's interesting too. Talking to the Hyundai execs, they're hyper aware of Lexus success and Infiniti and Acura's lack of success. So they know the business model. You actually find this across the luxury line. I was talking to a Ford regional rep in California last week, and they're hiring Lexus salespeople. I mean, there's a real awareness of what Lexus did right and investing in the brand and the customer experience. And Hyundai has done awfully well in the mainstream market. And I would give them a pretty good chance of success in luxury. They seem to be doing it right.
Yeah, they're an impressive company. I still remember, I want to say it was the year 2000, the chairman of Hyundai was speaking up at the management briefing seminars in Traverse City. And he bragged that they were going to become one of the top five car companies in the world. And I thought, well, yeah, not in my lifetime. Guess what? They're one of the top five companies in the world now.
Yeah. I'll tell you one reason I think they've got a chance is one thing Hyundai has, and they got it pretty quickly given where they were, they have quality.
Yep. Right?
And you look at, everybody seems to like whipping Fiat Chrysler automobiles these days. I think that the Alfa Romeos are gorgeous. Do I think it has a shot in this market as a luxury brand? No, because the quality of their cars in Europe and the Chryslers here, they're always lower on the totem pole in all the surveys. If you don't have quality, you're nowhere in the luxury business. You can get away with that with cheap Chrysler 200s
and rental cars. In the latest J.D. Power stuff, Kia was like number three. Hyundai was like number five out of everybody.
I want to say
Kia was ahead of Porsche. Mm-hmm.
They've been up there for a long time. Remember, it was a problem in the 90s and early mm-hmm. 2000s, and then they really made a concerted effort to improve the quality of their cars, and it's worked, and that's one of the reasons that they gained a lot of market share.
But here's the flip side of that, too, in that, Hyundai's had the Equus, their top-of-the-line luxury car now. I mean, the sales are really small. And if you look at on the Kia side, the K900, which I think is a terrific car.
It's
I think
a great
it
car.
Looks great. I think it's got all the bells and whistles. The quality's good. Mm-hmm. I think the sales last month were 62.
Yeah.
So, look, and most of that was LeBron.
Here's the problem. Here's the challenge they're going to have, and it is a problem. I think it's also a problem for Cadillac, is mm-hmm. you right now to sell anything in luxury and volume, it's basically got to be a crossover. That's the sweet spot of the market.
Yep.
To establish your brand and be legit, you need really cool sports luxury sedans like a 5 or a 7 Series, E-Class, S-Class, which aren't really selling right now. So you've got to establish yourself with something like a really great CT6 or some kind of great Equus sedan that is admired, so that you build the brand to sell these crossover luxury SUVs. Because you think about it, if you go and buy a Ford brand crossover SUV or a GMC, you can get it pretty well loaded with anything a luxury brand is going to give you. Mm-hmm. And they're not cheap. Mm-hmm. So to crack into that, you have to build a brand that is admired. And that's usually been done with sedans that have this sort of aura of prestige that even a crossover, you know, even an X5 doesn't have quite the elan that a 5 series has.
Well, they do have an awfully good start with the Genesis, which will become the G80. I mean, that's a really good car, really good value. It's the second best-selling retail, second best-selling car in that segment, in the midsize segment. So, you know, I think they came in. The Equus was a Korean car that was sort of adapted to this market.
Yeah.
But their real first North American market car, the Genesis, has done really well. And the product cadence goes right into the meat of the market from now on. They come in with a compact G70. They follow that with a compact SUV. So they know where the market is. Whatever marketing dictates, you have to do a flagship, whether it's a CT6 or a G90. But these guys know they know they got to ramp up production in the meat of the market. That's where the money is.
It does seem strange, though. When I was reading, too, about the product cadence, it seemed like the fact that they'd go 90, 80, 70, they're talking about doing a sports car, proper coupe. And I know that the crossover SUV will be in there too. It feels like maybe it should have been second, or first even. You can make an argument for based on sales. So
I think you're right. And I'll tell you this: if you're Cadillac, if you're Genesis, if you're Infiniti, and you're trying to either make your way or make a comeback, coupe's a waste of time and a waste of money.
It really is. You know, look at Jaguar, which has always been a sports car company, and going nowhere sales-wise, even though the cars are terrific, stunning-looking. They come out with the F-Pace, sales are off to the races.
Yeah.
That one F-Pace is outselling everything else that they've got put together.
Yeah.
And that, so, yeah, I think you're right, Seth.
But the F-Pace's identity is entirely caught up in the F-Type. That's why they call it an F-Pace.
Yeah.
Sure. So to your point at the top, you have to have a brand identity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, SUVs are not, you just put an SUV on the lot, it's a pretty unsexy looking thing. You know, if you don't have that F-Type.
50 yards away, they all look the same. Right?
I'm not so sure I agree. I mean, look at the Bentley Bentayga. That thing stands out. And I think it's going to do terrific for Bentley.
But we're talking about, you know, if you're taking all the mid-size crossovers from BMW, really any brand, 50 yards away. It's all the same shape. I'm sorry.
I mean, you don't sell a Cayenne unless you got a Porsche 911.
Porsches
speaking of Porsches, you've been out driving them, too.
Yeah, and the new Porsche Turbo. It's funny, we were out at Thunder Hill Raceway in 100 degrees. You know, only Porsche takes you to Northern California in 100 degrees, and you go out for 20-minute sessions and just flog this thing to death because this is a company that makes, you know, endurance race cars. So, that you know, that's their thing. You know, try this in any other high-performance race car, racing it hard for 20 minutes in 100-degree California heat. So it was a pretty neat test. And Hurley Haywood, who's a longtime great Porsche racer, does testing for the Porsche program. And I pulled him aside afterward and said, what do you think? And he said, you know, I didn't think they could beat the last gen, and this thing is that much better than the last gen. Mm-hmm. So the engineering just keeps getting better.
What makes it better? I mean, what sets it apart? What stands out in your mind that engineering-wise they did?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of things, but I think... I think we've been reporting in the Detroit News about Chevy Corvette developing a mid-engine car, and I think one of the big things that's driving that is the all-wheel drive component. I mean, once you get the engine out of the front and you put it as a mid-engine or a rear engine in the case of the 911, you can do a lot with all-wheel drive systems in the front. And that's what this Porsche Turbo is. I mean, it's got the all-wheel drive system down to the thing. It's a 3,700-pound car and rotates like a car much smaller than that because they're doing rear-wheel steering, they're doing torque vectoring off the front wheels. You know, there's a lot more you can do when you put the engine in the back. And they just get better and better and better at it. And their turbo technology, you know, I mean, you go back to the original Porsche turbos in the 70s, had a ton of lag. You would know this car is a turbo to map the accelerator. There's no lag.
Well, it's done electronically now, right? So they can time it.
It's remarkable.
You don't have to spool the engine up with a blower, basically.
Yeah.
So they're going to do a mid-engine Corvette?
Yes, they are.
And they're going to keep, do you think this is a clean sheet break with the past? And that there will be just one car?
There's a lot we don't know. I mean, they're going to keep producing, from what we're told, they're going to keep producing the front-engine car on into past 2020. And, you know, then speaking of brand identity, I mean, I think the drivetrain will be very similar to start with. It'll be, you know, small block V8. They'll just put it in the back. You know, they got to keep their costs down because that's their brand. They can't compete up in $160,000, $190,000 territory.
Why not? Why not with a mid-engine car?
With Porsche. Well, maybe they want to go there someday. But right now, that's, you know, Corvette's brand is, you know, $70,000 affordable supercar. And but I think they want
the Z06 go up. You can pay over 100 for that,
oh, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
110.
But what do you think, Seth?
I think that if you put a Cadillac badge on it, you can start charging other prices. And I that sounds crazy, right? Because Corvette could stand alone as a performance brand in my mind. You could certainly have two or even three products with a Corvette badge on it, and it would make a ton of sense, especially these days where you're selling more cars than ever. I think that you're right. I think that you have to be smart about it because if you have a $200,000 Corvette, things start to get a little bit strange.
Of course, you got a $400,000 Ford GT.
Fair enough.
And I think that's what's motivating GM to even think about doing a mid-engine Corvette.
My understanding was that if they did this, the mid-engine would be like a high-performance, you know, supercar that would be
like the Ford GT.
It'd be a
low
Corvette.
Volume, high price.
They'd use the Corvette brand, but it wouldn't replace the regular. Yeah. Corvettes that start at 60,000 and go on up to 110, you know, depending on which version you get, it would be mm-hmm. the supercar that sits above it, sells in the Chevy dealership.
Hybrid or no hybrid?
Oh, I don't know. I don't even know if what I'm saying is what they were deciding to do. I'm just telling you. All I'm telling you is this is one of the variations I heard on this idea that's been kicking around for. It's been a few years that they've wanted to do some kind of mid-engine Corvette.
So right. Hybrid or no hybrid? What would you do?
That's the advantage of going mid-engine. Initially, no. There's not talk of hybrid. I mean, again, they got to keep the cost down, this program. I mean, you know, we're...
No, you don't. You're going to charge a lot of money for it. That's what I'm saying.
This is a Chevy.
So what?
I mean, Ford GT builds that thing up in Canada at a specialty racing shop.
So why can't
they
do that?
Bowling Green, you got a full line manufacturer. They're putting almost $1 billion.
They build it in the back of the plant like that Camaro number one.
Maybe, but what I'm saying is you've got 50 years. You got 50 years. You got our generation has known a Corvette. You've got to start building this for future generations, and you've got to think about the technology. So you got kids that are growing up. On computer games, driving mid-engine supercars. I mean, if you want to keep this brand going, you got to adapt to modern technology. And so I think they badly want to go to mid-engine. That opens up the front wheels, so you can develop things like hybrid technologies, electric motors. Just allows you to expand the envelope of the brand going forward for another 50 years, if possible.
See, I'm with John. I think that brand has pricing power that's. You
could have three Corvettes. In fact, one of them could even be an SUV, SUV.
But you got to compete against Cadillac. Internally, they have to compete against Cadillac for capital.
So compete.
That's Cadillac.
I don't know. I think the XLR proved that Cadillac is nowhere in that part of the market. I think Cadillac can do cool sedans. I think Cadillac can do cool SUVs. But in terms of performance stuff, why would you waste the car in Cadillac? Seriously, Cadillac's got real issues right now.
Just establishing a 640 horsepower CTSV.
Right. But the V cars, they don't sell in great volume, whereas Chevy puts out a Camaro. The thing was an instant success. Yeah. The second generation's way more expensive than the first. The performance has gotten better. The Corvettes have gotten, I mean, look how expensive Corvettes now are versus 10 years ago, right? The thing starts at 60 or 65, and you can easily.
Corvette 53.
Yeah, you get one out the door for under 60. It's like the 3 Series that starts at 39. You'll just never find one that actually exists.
Not in nature,
but that's where you make your money. I mean, that's a great spread. I mean, you're going from 50 up to 110,000. Yeah. That's what's neat.
Absolutely.
That's what's great about that car. And again, so I don't think they're going to give that up. I mean, this mid-engine is going to come in at a reasonable price, but then you can scale it to potentially putting electric motors on the front. You know, and getting big spread there on your profit.
Well, look, you've looked more into the story than I have, Henry. But you know, I think they were stung at GM when Ford came out with this GT. They stole the Detroit Auto Show. They go and win Le Mans. It's like I think these guys at GM are pissed off. And when you look at the top level of technology, whether it's Formula One, but especially at Le Mans in the prototype class, they're all hybrids. And they're not hybrids for the environment or fuel efficiency. It's because those electric motors give you acceleration like nothing else does.
That's right.
The acceleration on the Mulsanne straight, when you see the hybrid cars against the non-hybrid cars, it's like the non-hybrid cars are anchored to the ground.
And look at, you've got McLaren, Ferrari, Ford, Acura with the NSX. It's kind of it's difficult for me to understand the mid-engine Corvette that starts as only a gas-powered vehicle and then goes to an electrified vehicle. That seems to go against sort of the, you know, the cool factor. Like the dominant model right now is to get all that added performance through electrification. It's, you know, it's the turbocharging of its era. You're getting a performance boost from it. So it's difficult for me to see them starting there. I get the price conversation, but. Yeah, I kind of think.
But you keep the current car. That's your price leader.
Yeah, like I said, there's so much we don't know. They got to do this right. They got to transition right. But you know, think of the Corvette's history, though. I mean, they've been talking mid-engine Corvette for a long time. There was a real battle inside Chevy in the early '60s to go mid-engine front engine. So there are a lot of mid-engine prototype show cars over the years. Lutz and Wallace. Got this program green-lighted in 2007, before the economy went into a tank. So they didn't have a full go, but they knew what they needed to spend. They had a green light from upper executives. So this program's been baking for a while, and now they're making the commitment.
Selfishly, I don't even want him to do it because mid-engine Corvette is the best car story on the internet since the invention of the internet.
Yeah.
So I would like them to not do it again, and then we can keep rewriting the same stories.
Yeah. Yeah. Keep getting the Loch Ness Monster photos of the the car testing out there. Yeah.
Think something could displace Tesla on the internet?
Well, you know, and that's a great point. You know, you look at the ludicrous mode of Tesla, and you see these S's, you know, videos online spanking these cars.
Ludicrous mode?
I have not, no.
It's nuts.
It really is. It's, look, I don't write for one of the buff books, so I don't get into, you know, a lot of the Ferraris and the super performance cars. I've been in some Lamborghinis and stuff. This is the first car I felt it was uncomfortably fast.
It makes you dizzy. You get so much torque off the line, it makes you dizzy.
My neck. I mean, yeah. I mean, it really, you know, it snaps you back like nothing else you've ever experienced.
Right.
It is ludicrous. It really is.
Well, you know,
it's doing the same 0-60 that this 580 Porsche Turbo is. They're both doing 2.8 0-60s. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
See, that's why, you know, I like the idea of hybrids. You know, not the Prius approach, but, you know, more like the Porsche 919 approach and just going for pure performance. And guess what? By the way, you do get better fuel economy.
That's what Lexus's first hybrids were all about. Were about performance.
Well, that's they
were
what supposed they
to
said.
Be. Yeah.
That's what the advertising said.
That was the
this
idea.
Is a performance hybrid. I didn't believe that either. Hey, real quick, I'm just really interesting. We're getting down to the end here. What did you guys think of Ford's headlong plunge into mobility and especially autonomy?
Well, look, they have to get in step here for a few reasons. I mean, one, all the companies are, if not in the back of their minds, in the front of their minds, worried that Uber and Tesla and Google will take a big bite out of their business over some period of time. Second thing is, for investors, you've got to have a story on Wall Street that says, we're a tech company. We get ride-sharing and ride-hailing. We get autonomy and what it means for that business. GM's got their story, right? They bought Cruise Automation. They bought a stake in Lyft, however Lyft may be challenged these days. But they've got their story out there. Ford didn't really have one. They didn't have anything at CES to say that we've got a big deal. And there were all these rumors that they were going to have a deal with Google, and it didn't happen. So now they've come out with a handful of technology investments, all to push autonomy and really get into this thing. This is a story they need to tell to potential investors and potential employees. If they want to hire code writers and people who come up with artificial intelligence, they've got to say we're investing in companies in the Valley. People at GM will tell you that. And we had this in our story, too, that it's tough to get Silicon Valley people to come here, necessarily, although that's getting a little easier. So you open shop there. Or GM bought Cruise Automation based in San Francisco, and they've been able to hire people because they'll work for this little Cruise silo within GM staying in San Francisco. So now Ford can get the talent by buying into these companies and then use that as a hiring base as well.
Yeah, they're doubling the campus that they have in Northern
That's
California right now and doubling the workforce that they have out there. So I think, you know, you come out with Fields writing an article being no steering wheel, no gas pedal, talk about the increase of the size of the staff that they're putting together. I agree. I think a lot of it is for the sake of the investors, for sure. But it does seem like the steps are logical and they understand that there are enough drivers out there right now who have no interest in being drivers. You know, if you could put them in the backseat of an autonomous car tomorrow, they would say, sign me up. What's the, you know, what's the monthly payment, essentially? So, yeah, I think it's not necessarily cynical so much as, I mean, it's forward-looking for sure. It's still difficult for me to understand exactly the model that they're trying to piece together for 2021 specifically.
Yeah, they may not know exactly yet either, and it's going to evolve over the next five years.
And one of the things that intrigued me about the Ford's announcement is they're talking about a car without a steering wheel.
Right.
Well, here's California that's just mandated
right. That
autonomous cars have steering wheels. So a lot of this has to go through government. I mean, there's a big regulatory piece.
Yeah, it does, but, you know, we did an interview with Mark Rosekind, the head of NHTSA, earlier this year. And he said, look, the law says that there has to be a driver in the car. He says the way we're looking at it at NHTSA is the autonomous system is the driver. So I think this stuff is, sure, it's not going to be automatic, but I think it's going to go through far faster than it ever would have in the past. Everybody recognizes this is a game changer. Everybody recognizes that if we don't jump on board right now, either the Germans or the Chinese are going to dominate this technology. Mm-hmm. So we better make sure that we're relevant to what's going on.
Well, it's another, there's the Tesla factor coming in here too, right? Tesla's autopilot has been such a huge story, for good and for bad. I think that it has changed the conversation for a lot of people. It's made them see a driverless car as being something more tangible than maybe they did before, because it's, you know, in so many headlines on so many websites. So,
well, and people are ready for it.
Look, totally.
I talked to the head of R&D at BMW, Klaus Froelich, and I said, you guys make ultimate driving machines. Where does autonomy fit in with you? And he said, look, the owner of an M5 loves driving his car, except for that last 10 minutes of his commute when he's in bumper-to-bumper traffic trying to find a place to park before he gets to the office. And then he would rather just click on the driver and start getting into his email or whatever he wants to do. And that's, you know, I think as a minimum, people will want it as an option in cars. And Ford's got to be ready for it, and it sounds like they're on their way.
Well, you know, we keep saying on Autoline Daily, every time we turn around, it's like another car company has announced some way of getting into ride-sharing, car-sharing, mobility, autonomy, whatever it is. And this conversation's far from over.
Yeah. No, it's really an extension of the, you know, of the Uber ride-sharing universe. I mean, I think that's what you're – I mean, you're right. There's a semi-autonomous bit where the driver's got a car, but there's also just that huge market out there of folks who are just taking Uber to work every day, who don't own a car.
Mm-hmm.
And
I wonder how much of that's going to happen, though, because the cheapest you can get an Uber is, what, $1.30 a mile? 15,000 miles a year?
That's expensive.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You could buy
three cars for that.
Right.
Lease three cars for that.
So for a subset of people who put on very low miles, it makes sense.
But you talk to the people who are really excited about autonomous vehicles or fleet operators, because all their overhead is human.
Mm-hmm.
It's all human beings and insurance. And so they love the idea of driverless cars.
Well, like I said, we're going to be talking about all this for many shows to come. But with that, we ought to wrap this one up. So I want to thank you all. Henry Payne, thanks so much for coming on.
Hey, John.
Everybody can read your stuff at DetroitNews.com.
That's it.
David Welch from Bloomberg. Yeah, great having you here. And Seth Mersma from Motor One.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, great having all of you. And want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
You have a live studio audience.
Yeah, I know.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv. If you guys want to hang around, you're free. We thought we'd do a little bit of Q&A with some of the interns here. Do you guys got any questions?
Who's intern? They're your intern?
Go ahead.
Yeah, please.
Whose interns are they?
Yeah.
Magna.
We should explain. They all work at Magna.
Okay.
And they're all about to head back to school, right?
Fortunately.
Yeah.
So, Henry, at one point you said, if you want to keep a brand going, you have to adapt to modern technology. So you touched on it a little bit, but I was just wondering, how that quote connects to autonomous vehicles and how the industry is changing in that sense, but how not the entire industry is changing. Some cars are moving forward, some aren't. So how will that separation impact the industry? And do you think the industry as a whole will be ready for autonomous vehicles in the next 10 years or just some? So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the good news about autonomous stuff as opposed to electrification is it's relatively affordable. You've seen the rush of technology come into cars in just the last 5 years. I mean, with the safety assist systems with cameras and radars that we used to just see in Mercedes and BMWs at the high end are all coming down into mainstream midsize Hyundais and even compact cars and Honda Civics. So I think the investment is a pretty quick payoff for them in that sense. And the younger generation, I know my kids get into a car and they want their smartphone to take over the car. They don't want to have to deal with a separate navigation system. All that's pretty easy. That's all electronics. That's pretty easy to do. I think the tougher lift for these companies is the regulatory lift of having to meet fuel economy mandates to require electrification. Those are big capital costs. So the digital stuff, I think, is going to happen, I mean, pretty fast. The autonomous piece is probably more as much regulatory, I think.
Legal and regulatory, and even insurance.
Yeah. Right.
You know, because we're probably going to see a migration in the insurance industry. Right now, it's all centered on product liability. Oh, your product had a defect. We're going to sue you. Well, what if now
the insurance company doesn't want to see this happen either?
No. they're scared because we're pretty sure there's going to be far fewer accidents and far fewer fatalities and injuries. And I think auto insurance is a $200 billion a year industry just in the United States. So, yeah, they're scared. But I think, like I said, that we're going to see a move from personal liability to product liability. And I don't know how the insurance industry is going to deal with that just yet.
Yeah.
There's also a little bit of a technical challenge in rolling, because you're right. Like, the systems exist on cars to keep the car safely in its lane and not hitting anything in front of it or behind it. But there's a mapping challenge, too. Ford bought a mapping company in this latest round. Sure. You know, Google's been working on millimeter-perfect maps. So having really – the digital maps that we have right now are very good. I can get to the studio from my house. I can figure out, you know, which roads to take. It'll tell me about traffic. But when you really get into the difference between a foot here and a foot there when the cars are driving themselves, I think that's a really big hurdle, getting that mapping data out there, having it quickly available, because we're talking about bigger files too, and then, you know, agreeing, I guess, on a standard, I guess, will probably be part of it as well. So,
yeah, good question. Who else? Go ahead.
So I was wondering what your guys' thoughts were on Uber and its fleet of driverless cars in Pittsburgh.
Yeah. Well, Henry touched on it. You know, all the fleet, whether it's trucking companies, whether it's Uber or Lyft, or they know that the biggest cost of their overhead is the driver. They'd love to get rid of the driver. And so, yeah, Uber formed an R&D center just outside of Carnegie Mellon, which may be the best university in the United States when it comes to robotics. Remember, Others will argue that.
They plundered Carnegie Mellon's staff.
Yeah, that's a good point. Right.
Really staff up their center.
No, so they, great point.
And from what I understand, they kind of gutted it. The university was not terribly happy that they were working with these guys.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
I mean, gutted might be a strong word, but they got a lot of the university's expertise.
Yeah, but everyone's racing to this. I mean, you may have heard stories of autonomous Chevrolet Bolts being tested in the Bay Area. Ford, when it made its announcement this week of going into autonomous cars, those are going to be ride-sharing cars. They're not going to be in showrooms. They're going to be run by, I don't know if it's Ford or if they're going to cut a deal with some sort of ride-sharing company or what the deal's going to be, but that's where it's all going. Get the driver out of the vehicle, because that's the single greatest cost.
Yeah, that's what makes the economics of of ride sharing and ride hailing work, where right now it probably doesn't, because Uber doesn't, you know, they're not making a lot of money. I don't think they're making any money.
Well, they claim they're profitable in the United States, but overall, none of us have seen the books, so they can say whatever they want.
And you know, I don't think Lyft is profitable. So, and that's charging really low rates per mile in order to make it economical, so that the business can grow and they can make money. They got to get the driver out. I mean, that's the bottom line on it.
I mean, human beings cause problems, right?
Yeah,
this
yeah.
is what it comes down to.
We need to eat and buy stuff.
Yeah, they're expensive.
Rent,
you look
mortgages.
At the. I've got a lot of friends in Austin, and they just had the big vote in Austin because they had this disagreement over paying for background checks, over the drivers having to have background checks that they didn't want to pay $20 for or whatever it was. So wherever you come down on that issue, the person behind the wheel can be a danger in many different ways, right? So.
But the other thing is we journalists we love to predict the future. You know, we're always trying to figure out where the future is. It's one of the things that interests us in this game. You're talking to the right sources and trying to figure out what the next big thing is. That's a big piece of journalism. But you know, there's also the real world. I mean, you know, when I got to this town 15 years ago, everybody was predicting hydrogen was going to happen tomorrow. There are huge real world barriers to hydrogen, primarily infrastructure. You know, how do people get the hydrogen filling? And I think it's the same thing. You go, I mean, it's great to talk about autonomous cars in the abstract, but then you go out on the road and you're out there with old cars, new cars, experienced drivers, not experienced. I mean, these autonomous vehicles got to fit with millions of variables. And so I think there's still a lot of hurdles that have to be overcome before you see this kind of car.
Well, the other part about autonomous, I think, that people forget about. So let's just agree that everybody in this room is or will be in the new car market looking at $30,000, which is the average price of a car these days, cars that cost $30,000 plus, right? That's not most of Americans, and it's getting to be less all the time. That's why Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump are so popular in this election, because a lot of people don't have any money. We've had wage declines for 15 years, right? Most people buy used cars, or they buy the cheapest new car they can get, and springing for another $30, $40 a month to afford the leather seats is beyond their reach. So if autonomy starts off as a $2,000, $3,000, $5,000 option, it's not going to happen for most of the buyers. And then there are a lot of people who are just buying these used cars that stay on the road for 12 or 15 years these days. So it's going to be a very long time where we have cars that are new and don't offer that technology or don't come with it, or just old cars clunking around on the road for a long time that don't have it either, because it's still, you know, for the affluent people who have the debate about autonomy, yeah, they'll get it in an option next year if it was available. For most car buyers out there, for most of the 17 million people, and then for what, 30 million people or whatever it is who buy used cars every year, 20 million, 23 million? I forget the number, but it's more than new.
Oh, it's right? 40 million
40,
for
yeah.
used cars.
Yeah.
But same thing that's...
They can't afford it, they're not going to get it.
And same thing that stalled electrification. You know, I mean, we're sitting here at 2% of the market. Again, 15 years ago, we all predicted that electrification would be a hot thing today. And it's just stuck at that 2% of the market. 50% of those are Toyota Priuses. You know, because it's, you know, for most buyers, it doesn't make sense to pay that premium for, you know, and not get it back in gas savings.
I think that the only thing that maybe defies, because I don't think anything you guys said is wrong, but the only thing that defies it is if you get to a point where you actually can break the car ownership model. If you really are, we're not talking about rideshare, but if you're talking about you order a car that's autonomously driven that isn't owned by you at a rate that's affordable on a commuting basis, I think that there's that works once you scale it to a certain level. I think that there are a lot of people who would want that service.
It'll all come down. You're exactly right. It'll come down to cost. Is it cheaper for me to buy a new car or a used car or to go and just buy my mobility when I need it?
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to buy this depreciating asset that's parked for 23 hours. I'll just buy my mobility when I need it.
I think a lot of people will do that, and I've been skeptical of it. But there's still an issue with that, which is most people still need that car that they all want to share at the same approximate time.
Mm-hmm.
They need it at 8 in the morning, and they need it at 5 to 6. So, you know, that's going to have constraints, and the constraint is if you've got fleets or owners you're going to have these sort of bottleneck time periods where it may not be economical or convenient to have this rideshare car because you're going to need it. Everyone needs it at the same time. And that's always been the problem with fleet management companies, is figuring out how many cars they need to manage the peaks and troughs of demand. For rental car companies, you know, it's seasonal. That's why they used to buy these things to a degree on 3- and 6-month contracts, because you have your vacation months and you have your months when fewer cars are being rented. Now you're trying to break this down in 8-hour segments to figure out when the cars are going to be used. That's a very... Now, that's why Uber works now, because you have a bunch of drivers. Someone needs a car, they go, they find a guy who's driving at that time. But if it's an autonomous car and everybody needs it at 5 o'clock and no one needs it at 9,
That's why cars are so awesome. That's why they're such a great piece of individual transportation. They're always there when you need it.
That's right. Other questions? Go ahead.
So with the competition between OEMs now and electronic companies like Apple and Google and Leco trying to gain a competitive edge in the automotive industry, especially with the race for autonomous vehicles now, how is that going to change the way that suppliers conduct businesses with, you know, with these manufacturers who make these cars?
Good question. Yeah. You know, I think
we should be asking you that.
Yeah, that's right.
You're the ones who've been turning a supplier.
Right. Right. You know, it's all early. This is going to evolve very, very quickly. But right now, what we're seeing is mini consortiums starting to get together. So, for example, BMW just announced a consortium that includes Intel and Mobileye, the Israeli company that does vision synthesis. Ford just announced, you know, that it's going with this company called Sipes, another Israeli company, and some neurology company that does a lot of deep learning things.
Yeah, LLC in New York. That was
Continental, but you know, another supplier is out actively trying to start a consortium. So I think what the race is on right now. Who's going to come up with systems that they might sell to anybody? Which I think is Google's approach. I think Google wants to develop a, you know, autonomy in a box, as it were, and sell it to anybody.
Maybe Apple, too.
Ford said, we're not buying anybody's. We're developing our own. BMW is clearly developing its own. So I think we're going to see different business models, and we're going to see different suppliers join these different consortiums, and the race is going to be on. And as I, you know, talked about earlier in the show, who's going to set the standard? Who's going to set the global standard for this? You know, is it going to be in China? Is it going to be in Europe? Is it going to be in the U.S.? Right now, at least, it looks like South Korea and Japan are way behind as countries, not necessarily as companies. Toyota's spending a fortune on artificial intelligence research in the United States.
Remember, wasn't the self-parking Prius the first car out there with any kind of...
Well, there was a Lexus that was self-parking.
Was it a Lexus before the
Prius? I defy anybody to make it work. The first one that worked was
Lincoln. They were
doing
work on this a long, long time ago.
Yeah.
And so was Mercedes, for that matter, because they were the first one with the adaptive cruise in like 2000 or something, right?
Yeah, right.
So there's been a lot of work being done on this. The suppliers will do business with anybody who needs the technology. And some of the suppliers are quite good at developing. Delphi's got some good stuff. Continental has some very good stuff.
Yeah, right.
So those guys will be, you know, working on this pretty well, too. They'll probably partner up. What I think you'll see is companies like the suppliers and the automakers doing what Ford did, which is partnering up with Silicon Valley companies, because that's where the code writers and algorithm writers and artificial intelligence expertise is. And it's just in that community.
Right.
Well, to that point, my son was an intern with NVIDIA, which is a big graphics chip maker in Silicon Valley. And now that you have so much so many electronics and this autonomous talk coming into cars, these big chip makers, and I mean, you used to have a chip community that was part of the automotive community. That were pretty low-end chips. Now the demands of autonomous and these consoles are such that you need much more higher powered chips. And so NVIDIA sees a big growth market in cars.
And so my son, who now works for NVIDIA, he makes chips on the phone side, but they have a big auto division that didn't exist 10 years ago, and they're now in Audi, and they're working with Tesla on their autonomous car. So that's an auto supplier that didn't exist a decade ago. I was just in Google. John was talking about the system that Google's trying to develop for the console, the sort of a basic operating system, so you can bring any device into the car. And the chip maker for that system is Qualcomm. Qualcomm wasn't in autos 10 years ago. Qualcomm is the major chip maker for smartphones. And so they see big opportunity in cars. So, I think you, with this autonomous and electrification of or the electronics coming into cars, you see Silicon Valley and Detroit becoming closer and closer.
They're very interested. The Valley's definitely interested in this. You know, I mentioned Intel earlier.
To, right?
Oh, they needed to. But, you know, Intel always fought automotive. It's low margins. It's too competitive. We're never going to deal with them. They're part of the BMW consortium. I mean, so the Valley really sees this move to autonomy. Or I really like talking about the umbrella catchphrase I call mobility services, which is electrification, and it's ride sharing and car sharing and all this other stuff, and you know, beyond just automotive mobility. But that's where the race is on really right now. Mm-hmm. Who's going to emerge as the brand that people go to?
Mm-hmm. Well, look, the problem that the traditional auto companies, and I put the suppliers in this as well, is that they, for years, they were run by accountants, and then all the projects were done by engineers. So what does that mean? It's got to have return on investment, or I don't want you playing with that. And you know, we'll let you play with it for a while if it doesn't, but not forever. And then, that's really cool, but we don't redesign that car for 3 more years, and you can't put it in a mint cycle. So can you just put that on the back burner for a while and wait until Tesla does it? And that's what happened, right? So Tesla was the first company to, like, download stuff over the air for, you know, real fixes to the car. And GM can do some stuff with OnStar, but, you know, Tesla was the first one to do this, and everyone should have been able to do this. And I've talked to every car executive I've talked to. I said, when are you guys going to be able to pull something out of the dashboard in my 2015 model and put in the new hardware that I need? Well, we'll do all that with software. We don't want to do anything in the mid-second. You can do stuff with software, but that doesn't always do it. And I've got a 2011 Mini, and I can get all kinds of cool electronics upgraded in there if I want. But the screen and the interface completely sucks. It's already out of date for everything I want to do. The car companies say, oh, no, this is not possible. You know, it's what you get, because they don't want to pull anything out on them. It's like you've got to be able to have that Silicon Valley mindset of, oh, our product doesn't do that? What's that take? A month? Okay, yeah, you can do that. You know, and they just do it. Yeah. And, you know, profits be damned.
They got enough profit.
But there's a mindset that the traditional companies don't have to get things in much faster and update things.
Right. Last question. Anybody?
Can we ask you?
Okay, you got one more? Okay, let's hear it.
This is a little different than the last questions. But being a journalist in the automotive industry, what was something that surprised you or you didn't expect about your career when you entered? So maybe going into it, you weren't thinking you'd do this, or you wouldn't experience something, and now it surprised you.
Well, I can say is that I got into this business as a cartoonist, so and now I'm an auto writer. So you know, the newspaper industry has changed so dramatically in my 25 years that I'm now a cartoonist and an auto writer. So. And, for me, and a lot of it's been driven by digital, by the internet. You really got to be flexible. You got to be able to take on different jobs as the industry changes. So that's I couldn't have told you I'd be an auto writer when I got into this industry 25 years ago.
Yeah, it's a strange thing. Like I've been in digital my entire career for about 12 years now, I guess, and. I never expected that there would be, even going into that as kind of a writer with, you know, aspirations to be an editor, I didn't think that there would be so much aiding in software development, web design, really the working with marketing of a website and things like that, the nuts and bolts of it, that's really important. You know, I think that journalism as a whole is changing, especially as it's in the digital environment, in that, you know, boundaries are broken down all the time between sort of where the money comes from, what you're writing about. Things aren't quite as cut and dry as they used to be, too. And it's interesting. It makes the challenge of telling the truth and telling a good story more difficult, I think, as time goes by, but also involves evolving models, too. So,
well, there's all the technology. You know, when I got into the business, nothing was digital, absolutely nothing. You know, I literally started on a manual typewriter. But that's not what has surprised me the most, you know, because technology, you know about technology before it hits, and you don't know exactly where it's going to go, but you know it's coming. So, you know, the internet, all that kind of stuff, you know, I saw it coming. What has surprised me in my career is, and this has happened several times, it happens once about every 5 years or so, when I think I really understand how this auto industry works, I learn something new that tells me you don't know nothing. You have no clue what's really going on. And this has happened to me several times during my career where I'm thinking, pat myself on the back, John, you're pretty good at this, you know this. And then I find out, here's another part of the business I had no clue about. I had no idea what this was doing. And that's been the real surprise to me in my career.
Let's see, specific to media, I thought digital would allow us to do more long, in-depth stories, because the limits used to be the size of the news hole in a print newspaper or a magazine. You have X number of ads, that dictates how many pages you have, that dictates how much space you have to write unless they cut somebody else's story for yours. And there were fights over space, so that was how, you know, the old Business Week, we had 6 or 7 pages for a cover story was a lot of real estate. You usually got 5, and then as the magazine did worse and worse and it got thinner, it was 3 or 4. And I thought, man, once we're digital, you got as many screens as you want, just keep writing away. Digital has actually taught people to, because they're like a kid under the Christmas tree with 30 presents instead of 3. So they don't spend any time with either any of the presents because there are 30 of them. They got to look at all of them and keep going back and forth instead of 3 and then actually playing with one for a while. They don't spend as much time on your story. So they don't, you know, nobody, no editor thinks anyone wants to read 10, 12 pages of your stuff. So you don't get it. We think that we're convinced anyway that readers have a short attention span, so we're not doing as much long-form stuff. And it's not just where we are, where I am. It's every news organization, I hear the same thing. It's really tight story counts. Even the New York Times isn't doing these, like, super long 3 pages of newsprint. Print edition pages anymore.
Although, did you see the Times magazine this last weekend?
No.
It's one story. No way.
We did an issue like that in Business Week on Writing
Code. I could not put it down. I could not put the story down.
Was this the thing on
the collapse of the Arab world?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I saw that online.
Really powerful.
Yeah,
and I think that is changing. I think that, you know, talk about how the content types and the content forms are evolving. The reason that things had to be so short, like at a basic level up to this point, is because display advertising is a really difficult way to make income. You've got to refresh that page. You've got to click on that page as many times as possible. So if you're BuzzFeed's a bad example, but if you're making lists where people are having to click over and over again, you're incrementally increasing your revenue. That model is getting sort of, it's never really made enough money to support the industry.
It's also kind of a scam, right?
It sucks, right. Yeah, it sucks on a lot of levels. Yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, there were stories that, I mean, there are certain publications you go and you want to read a story that's, you know, really only like 800 words, and they make you click through like 7 pages to get through it just to jack up. And advertisers got wise to this, right? That this web page, this site was not really generating that much activity. They were just forcing the reader to click again to keep reading the same article. And you weren't really getting that much more advertising exposure.
Either. Sure. Yeah. And I mean, I think that, as you know, Google search engine sort of understands that they want a lot of things, but they say that they want to make a good experience for the person who's using the site too. So they're kind of pushing that to go away. So it changes where your money comes from changes the type of content you're able to do, obviously. And I've seen there's been a resurgence both, even in automotive, doing like longer form stuff. There's a website called The Drive that's a Time Inc. property, and I think The Drive is great. They're not a year old, maybe, and they've done a lot of like longer form stuff. They've been, paying writers pretty well so that they can get really good content and tell really great stories. It's certainly happening outside of the autos, kind of autos endemic too. All over the place. And the question really is now, are you going to be able to offset it with different kinds of advertising money to support the writers and editors?
Because even like Business Insider and some of the big sites that are doing that stuff are cutting back because it just hasn't, the revenue hasn't been enough.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
Hey, we got to wrap up. We've got to let the crew go and let these interns get back to work.
Thanks for the applause.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks. It's been fun having you guys here.